Oh, come on, I've got the I'm mostly over my hangover session this morning. What's going on? Good morning, Tech Ed.
Good morning.
You all came to a session on application packaging and it's not even 1999. That is impressive. Well, welcome. Before we begin, because we are talking about application packaging, I kind of needed to go out and find myself a sponsor for this one. So today's session is going to be sponsored by Windows 8. So before we begin, a brief word from our sponsor.
Years and years ago, in 2005, computers used to look like this. Back when I was 1 year old. Look at this thing! It weighs way more than me!
With Windows 8, my surface looks this small!
And it is so much more powerful!
And it also features Android Tuggery Control.
That's what a UAC for all your non-hackers out there.
It keeps me safe when people try to hack me.
And it my credit card number stolen 5 times! I wouldn't have a credit card!
Now I'm protected by application isolation. It keeps me safe when I run my Windows 8 apps.
Those are lots of bad happenings.
Thank you. I think there might be some child labor laws against that, but I'm very successfully ignoring them. So I want to talk about application packaging today and a little bit of background on me and the story and the journey I've gone through leading up to this talk. I'm commonly known as the AppCompat guy, as evidenced by my Twitter handle. My email alias is appcompatguy@microsoft.com. My blog is at appcompatguy.com, and I've spent about the past 7 years working with customers who are moving to the latest version of Windows, the latest version of IE, the latest version of Office, and so forth. And along the way, we've noticed some, shall we say, opportunities in the world of packaging. When we look at application failures on installed Windows applications, we see an application failure rate representing somewhere on the order of 60% of the blocking issues when we have application failures on Windows, which is remarkable. Now, that doesn't mean that the install failure is the only failure they hit. It just means that if you don't work, you probably also don't install. And it's this kind of quality metric that's bringing us back to the drawing board. When we look at where we came from the last time we, Microsoft, had a conversation with our customers on packaging was back when this slide was explaining how things worked. This was a Tech Ed slide from 2000, the last one that I could find in this conversation. When I looked for really good articles, not just an article, but something that was worthwhile, this is the most current one that I found. Back from the Microsoft Systems Journal, which doesn't even exist anymore. It eventually morphed into MSDN. We really just haven't been having the conversation. We released the Windows Installer Framework and we said, all right, we're done. Go have fun. Install and be merry. And we're noticing that we have some really significant quality issues that are simply not being addressed today by us or anyone. When we look at what the rationale is behind this incredibly low quality bar, we find that it's really based upon no initiative to get good. We think we're good enough. When was the last time we had people going, wow, we really need to work on the overall quality of application issues on Windows? You haven't heard it, but it's a systematic problem. It's more than just that 60% failure rate during platform transitions. When we look at the data that we get from System Center, we look at some of the service quality metrics that come into place, an average failure rate of package installs is about 8%. Basically, one out of every 12 times, you take something whose sole purpose in life is to install software, it doesn't do it. And we're okay with that. And what I'm noticing is that we've kind of gone on the pendulum full circle. We started off on one end saying, packaging MSIs, it's brand new, it's complex. Let's get some really expensive people to come in and make this happen for us. And I know some people who made some pretty good money that way. A buddy of mine bought his estate in the countryside of England with his earnings from being a packager. But then we swung it all the way to the other side and we said, packaging is a commodity, and nearly all of the packaging work that is done offshore in a lowest price model. And the resulting quality has caused people to rethink that. The most common request I get nowadays for packaging is, I want to go back and bring it back onshore because the stuff I'm getting from offshore is really terrible. So I want to start thinking through how do we address the quality issues and deal with the psychology behind the state of affairs as they exist today. And when I look at where we are and what's being done, it really boils down to some of the fundamentals of how people get good at things. Right? The three stages of learning from Fitz and Posner say we're going to start at the cognitive stage. We don't know how to do it. This is where we're looking things up in MSDN. We're looking things up in the help manual. We're going and taking classes. We're trying to figure out what this thing is, and we're actively thinking about how we can do it. Then we move into the associative stage where we actually have some sense of what we're doing, and eventually we get to the autonomous stage, which is the stage at which we are now just running on autopilot, and we're just getting it done. And our goal has historically to get to that autonomous stage as quickly as possible. And in the world of doing things, that autonomous stage is really what brings you to a plateau. As soon as you get to that point, you stop getting better. And my strong belief is that we've set that plateau entirely too low. When we look at where we are with application packaging, most people figure out, how do I do a snapshot install using the tool that I've bought and remove some of the really egregious errors that come from snapshot installs? And once I've learned how to do that, that's all the better I need to do. Give me your next 1,000 packages. And then we move forward from there. And it really sort of lines up with the way that we love to behave. When you look at the way that the brain works around mastering tasks, the brain scan on your left, sorry, I had to turn around there and see where that went, looks at when you're doing something that you have to think about versus the one on the right, which is taking a task that you're doing when you are already in that autonomous stage and you're just executing. And you don't have to think at all. This is a psychology of habit. It's incredibly rewarding. People love to be in this stage. And that's what we have to break out of, because that is the difference between being a golfer like this guy, who gets just good enough to play golf, and being a golfer like this guy, who's constantly looking for ways to get better by focusing on his weak spots and staying out of the autonomous stage. Although I must say, this guy looks far more awesome. And that's where it comes down to deliberate practice, which is something we don't focus on in the realm of packaging. We focus on volume, we focus on cost, as opposed to techniques to help us get better. And focusing on goals and getting feedback. And the big challenge we have with feedback is that it comes so late in the game. We look at the difference between an amateur and a professional. An amateur, if they're say, playing guitar is going to just play a song that they know over and over and over again, whereas a professional, a la Eddie Van Halen or Steve Vai or someone who's actually really good, focuses on doing very tedious exercises that stretch the muscles and stretch their brains to think of new ways of doing things. If I'm an ice skater, I focus on doing the jumps I already know how to do pretty well over and over again versus taking the ones I always miss and continuing to miss them over and over again. And it is this difference between how do I continue to improve versus how do I get to a plateau where I can do it all and keep moving forward that represents the core challenge. Doing something for a long time doesn't make you good at it. So when I look at people who are saying, I've been doing packaging for X number of years, I say, well, how good have those packages been, and how do you continue making them better? And this quality, this continuous improvement, is something we haven't really looked at too much, and we're starting to look at now. We have the ability to keep doing things better. We've got better technology today, better tools, but we're not getting better outcomes. We look at some of the history behind continuous improvement. Roger Bacon in the 13th century said, you can't master everything that's known today until you spend 30 or 40 years studying it. The level of mathematics that was in existence when Roger Bacon was alive are taught to our children now by the time they finish junior high. So we've kept getting better. We keep getting better in Olympic sports. We look at the world records as they happen. What really ends up being the differentiator is, hey, now we know we can go faster than that. Here's our new benchmark. Let's figure out a way to get past that. Why does it matter to keep getting better in packaging? Why did I just spend 15 minutes talking about psychology at a technical conference? It's because the ability to focus on getting better and better and better has a really dramatic financial impact on the money that's not being spent on building new capabilities. There are approximately 19,000 organizations that we would consider to be an enterprise in the world today. On average, when they are in a well-managed state, they have around 2,500 applications. On average, an application package costs an organization around $522. So the total financial impact of shipping garbage that we have to redo every few years, every time we change things, ends up being in excess of $2 billion. We've got a lot of waste. When we start thinking about some of these financial impacts, what do you think is the estimated cost it took the world to move from Windows XP to Windows 7? And oh, by the way, we're not done yet. You know what we estimate that cost as? In excess of $1 trillion. All spent moving because we've not been focused on quality and we've not been focused on making things better. There's a huge opportunity here to get better. We need to seize the opportunity to stop sucking and do something different. For the modern era, the differentiator is no longer quality because we need to change that mindset and focus on long-term. How good is that package? Did I get what I was asking for? It gets really hard. A lot of the conversations I have with enterprise customers, they have an environment in which they have competitive bidding, and it's all about whoever meets the lowest number they possibly can, as opposed to the lifetime of that, living with it, how much does it cost me to have that? Because this is where we end our certification on most packages when we get them from somebody. One person on one machine installs it, notices it works, and says, hooray, now you get your money. It works on my machine. Without any regard to how did that continue working in my environment? And did it start to allow me to take that same package and use it in System Center, use it in, you know, Windows Intune, and use it across operating systems. Did it transition nicely to Windows 8, Windows 8.1, or did I have to go back and do it over? We don't get that metric. We get one single point in time to measure that quality. And the quality metrics that come back over time have a lower and lower impact on what we're building. This is what we really need to focus on changing. How do we get that long-term impact of this had a really big cost over the lifetime of the package that I choose not to pay anymore? Are we going to start building sustained engineering for our packages so that we no longer have this externality? An externality is when you have a cost, but you don't pay it. Because right now, packagers, particularly if they're outsourced, have a lot of externalities. There are costs of having a low-quality package, but they've already gotten their money. They're done, and away they go. Do we start tracking and analyzing and understanding those failures and fixing them when they're our fault? And do we start looking at refunding your money if we give you something that sucks? That's the opportunity to start looking at measuring things over time and using those metrics to start to build checklists. Checklists are a really remarkable way to go through and help resolve problems. The pilot's checklist, for example, came about in the 1930s or 40s, I forget which. It was during testing of a bomber, eventually became the B-1 bomber, and it was so much more complicated to fly than any other plane out there that basically some people went up, they forgot to do one thing. As a result, the plane was completely immovable and just ran right into the ground. And they said, oh, well, this plane is the problem. And they analyzed and said, no, the plane is not the problem. The plane doesn't crash into the ground. It was pilot error because these things are so much more complicated than they used to be previously. So let's build a checklist that says, remember to turn off these locking things so that you're able to turn the plane and not ram into the ground. And they based it on real-world experiences that said this becomes a problem. And we took the exact same approach in the medical industry. They said, hey, this is helping pilots around the world not drop their planes into the ground. That's really useful. There is a really big problem in surgery with a lot of preventable errors happening. Let's build a checklist to address those preventable errors. And this has been enormously successful worldwide, driven by the World Health Organization. We should do the same thing in packaging. Based upon actual long-term data, not based upon the convenience of building them in the first place. I've seen a lot of packaging request forms or packaging, you know, forms to fill out to make, you know, I want this thing packaged up in this way by this date. And most of the quality checks that are built in, right, I would say probably on average of a third to a half of it, standards for building a package, determine the name. We use this naming convention. If you don't have this thing, then we use this in spite of this naming convention. Well, how big of an impact do you think the name of a package has on its long-term cost to the organization? And why are we spending so much time talking about it? That's our opportunity. Now, what are we building? What's out there today? And why have we kind of seem like we've been standing still? And why are people making the decisions that they do? Well, here's where we came from. Setup.exe. In fact, even before this, I have got an old copy of Jeff Richter's Windows 3.1 book that has the old INF format for installing software. Setup.exe was kind of the big standard, and what we notice is that on average, we see a failure rate at broad deploy in an enterprise organization of around 25%. That's the spark that made MSI come to exist. That's the spark that caused organizations to embrace it, is that this is a really high failure rate because it's arbitrary code that can go wrong in all kinds of ways. So we moved to Windows Installer, and that reduced the percentage of failures down significantly. As I said, we're somewhere around 8% today, which is still pretty terrifyingly bad. Which is why AppV is such a home run when it comes to cutting costs, because it just works most of the time. And that's based purely on it's doing less stuff that's hard to do. Windows Installer is lots and lots of code that's really, really well tested. And oh, by the way, you can throw custom actions in there. Those represent the vast majority of the failures that come into play. AppV is a single file, which you can tell if it copied correctly, and then inside of the file, it sort of sprays information out that also has checks built in so you know that it's copied correctly. It's as easy as Xcopy. And that's where the value comes in place. One thing I didn't mention is ClickWants. I didn't mention it because I haven't really seen people embrace it. Right? So to me, that doesn't seem like the future. What does is something called open packaging conventions. So to explain that, I wanted to kind of take a tour through what we, Microsoft, have been doing in regards to open packaging conventions. And they kind of came about for Office. So the first time we saw them was in Office 2007, where we put together the specifications to, you know, for OpenOffice XML that really explains, all right, here's how you put together a package that contains information. And kind of the home run that we talked about there in terms of why would you make this transition to this file format versus the old file formats was it saves disk space. Right? That's your business value conversation. On average, it's about 50% of the disk space to save a DOCX versus a DOC. And similarly for XLSX versus XLS and so forth. It just ends up being smaller because it's impressed and compressed in ways that work better. So we've got this long set of definitions and we focused on one particular aspect of the business value. The question is, what is this thing? It's a zip file. And I can rename the zip file and start burrowing inside of it. I can see the content types that are buried inside of it. These are the content types. Sort of translates all of them for it. And it's just a new way of containing information. I have resources. I've got a dictionary. I can look at the contents there. It's all standards-based. All of these standards are documented. I can go and see what this file format is. There's an SDK for building these types of files to simplify it, or I can go down to the raw text if I want to. Designed to greatly simplify that. But we didn't stop there. When we look at what we're doing for APEX files, they're also using open packaging conventions. So if I rename it to a zip file, I can see what's inside of it, and I can see the manifest. This gives me information about the application. This is what can appear in add/remove programs. This is what can show up on an advertisement. It's all laid out very clearly here. But from a success standpoint, this block map is what lines me up to all the files. Here's this file, default.css. It's this size, and it has a variable number of blocks with a hash, so I can check to make sure that this block was copied successfully, one by one by one. So when I start to think about what could I do with this type of file format, suddenly I've got built-in error checking that I didn't have before. I have digital signatures built into the whole format for how I put things together, and I can start to think about ways in which I could do an offline install, which is what I hear a lot of folks on the IT pro side asking for, which is, wouldn't it be great if I could install an app? Because right now I've got to wake up the operating system, run the install, recapture it, And now I've got a new whim with that app installed. Wouldn't it be great if I could do an offline install? Well, with this highly descriptive format, I could. Now today, there are still some intermediate steps you have to take in terms of expanding the contents out, but it becomes possible, and it's defined that way. And we take a very similar approach. Get this back to AppX. In AppV. If I look at an AppV package, it also is using open packaging conventions. So if I delve into this one, I can see, oh, I'm even using the exact same AppX format that I did for my AppX files. If I look at the block map, the exact same layout. Here's a file. This file has a series of blocks with a given size, with a given hash, so I can do a checksum on it and make sure that it got copied correctly. It's the exact same thing. So directionally, that's where we're going. Let me introduce to you something most people I talk to haven't heard of. That is a new domain-specific language we've put together called the Auto Package Format. We have an open source initiative called CoApp. Has anyone heard of that before? Yeah, no one? No, yeah, it's kind of what I thought. That's why I figured I'd spend some time talking about it. CoApp, the idea behind what we're trying to do here is to build a domain-specific language that allows us to build packages. So this language you can see here, it's a plain text language. It doesn't have sort of all the XML angle bracket stuff. It's basically very declarative. Here's, you know, targeting NuGet. Here's the spec. Here's the author. Here's the owner. Here's where the license is. Here's where the project is, descriptions, and so forth. A tightly defined language that lets me define how to build a package. And today, we have a series of PowerShell applets that we distribute that allow you to start from this domain-specific language to build packages. Today, those packages are NuGet packages. Most non-developers have never heard of NuGet packages. NuGet is our open source way of integrating new functionality and new code into Visual Studio. So if I navigate to the desktop and then navigate to this example, then I can create a NuGet package based upon this domain-specific language. Using a PowerShell script, it's going to go through and create three. And now that it's created them, I can go and take a look and say, oh, here they are. And guess what's inside of them? NuPKG is a zip file. Wrong one. Open packaging conventions. So you're starting to see this way of aggregating content become more consistent across the products that Microsoft delivers, across Office, AppV, AppX, NuGet. Like this notion that you have a number of different content types you want to bring together. The one convention that unifies all of them is open packaging conventions. It's an open standard that anyone can reuse that we are using absolutely everywhere. I can see what's in here. Here's the package. publisher info, here's the native code, here's the binaries. I can see all of the different targets all put together inside of this open packaging convention container. And how that would integrate, it integrates directly with Visual Studio, which supports NuGet packages. And I would simply open up some C++ application. I'll pick this one. And then from within this application, I can just say, all right, let me scroll up here. Manage NuGet packages. I can say, all right, well, where are we getting them from? Well, I'm going to add a new location. And I'll call it me. This is naming after me, why not? And I'll just go to the desktop and say, all right, we can have a little packaging store right on my desktop. And then if I go look, I can say, oh, there are three packages there. Typically, you wouldn't point this to your desktop. You point to some internal share. But this is a way internally to package source code to share across an organization, all managed with tools that are freely available. And I can add this SDK. I can install it. It will bring all of those things into place, add them automatically. And now I'm integrated directly into my Visual Studio project. All right, great. So we've now just shown something that is useful for pretty much developers only who are wanting to share stuff with the packaging format. And that's really kind of where we are today with it. No groundbreaking announcements or anything, but I did want to point out some of the things that we've been looking at. We look at what's happening in the co-op world. We're looking at, should we design some kind of service and user-based interaction? Looks kind of like MSI, doesn't it? MSI has msiexec.exe running as a service. The exact same binary also runs in user mode. They communicate back and forth to each other. We've got a very similar design. We have looked at how the client should look like for updates and how the client should look like for installs and app stores. So we're not there yet. The future, however, very clearly is pointing towards open packaging conventions. The interesting thing is that it's not really being heavily invested in by the product team. This innovation is coming from the open source side of Microsoft, which is buried inside of server and tools. So when we put together the package as we have it today, we have three different significant open source projects that come together to build the consolidated installation story that we have right now. We have NuGet, which is targeting the developer scenarios in a way to share source code amongst companies, which I think a lot of organizations could benefit from. A lot of organizations really today aren't doing source code packaging. They're doing copy-paste sharing. And there's opportunity there. CoAP is a way to bring that together. CoAP really, at its essence, is a domain-specific language for building packages. Today, those packages are NuGet packages. Tomorrow, they might be something else. And there have been builds where they have been something else. And third is, how do I build for traditional packaging methods? That's with Windows Installer XML and where it is going. Those are the investments that we're making today. Little more detail. What are we trying to do with NuGet? We're trying to help people share libraries, share SDKs, and make that simpler. We want to have really high fidelity integration with Visual Studio, really high fidelity integration across the board with all of the development tools, be they open source or be they proprietary. CoApp is designed to help build that packaging technology for this new world, a full package management experience, eventually evolving into a full setup experience, because the other opportunity we have in the packaging world is that packages tend to target one environment. And applications are no longer targeting that same environment over and over again. Instead, they're starting to span multiple client and cloud-based OSs, private cloud, public cloud, and we need a setup technology that allows us to span that and a language that supports that. So if we look at some of the tools that we already have exposed via CoApp, we have the ability to start exposing services and having RESTful APIs being at the core of all of that. Windows Installer XML, I actually don't run into a lot of people who know what this is. How many of you have heard of Windows Installer XML? How many of you use it? How many of you think it's the best tool out there for building Windows Installer stuff? So-so. Why do you use it?
Because you can incorporate into build processes.
Because you can throw it into a build as opposed to having to launch a separate tool. And you can check it into source code control. We actually use Windows Installer XML for most everything we ship at Microsoft. And Windows Installer XML has been looking to build towards new targets, including a new setup engine that we've been exploring and developing. So it's all about this syntax, although that's starting to evolve, and we're looking at how do we differentiate between what is the target environment for CoApp, what's the target for Wix, and where do those two things meet in the middle. What's interesting to me is that, apparently not feeling the love, the guy who spent most of the time running Windows Installer XML decided to open a consulting company to help people use Windows Installer XML because, hey, he might know a little something about it. And he's making a lot more money than he used to working at Microsoft developing Windows Installer XML, helping people build things on top of that. And this is the trend we're seeing over and over again is people are noticing the long-term quality of what has been built and they're rejecting the commoditization of packaging. So we're trying to help build the tools to make that easier. I'd hoped to have some new tools to show you, but you know we are where we are today. It is a gradually evolving space where we are taking this OPC concept and trying to drive it forward. And we're really trying to make sure that we can cover the gamut of where setups need to be to get things done, right? We have a series of applications that today are looking at hitting the global scope or the operating system scope, and that scope we think is important. It is today the default in legacy Windows environments. And I see that moving more and more away from being the default. I see that for frameworks, things like, you know, if you want to install a Java runtime, right, that's something that tends to apply to the system. It's used by a lot of things. If I have a system service, that is at the OS scope. But more and more moving to, at a minimum, the user scope is becoming more of the norm. When I look at what we did with ClickOnce, that was a per-user install method. The ability to target an app at a single user and have every single user pull it. Same thing with something like AppV that allows me to make it per user. Same thing with AppX files in Windows 8. Those are per user installs. Because the notion of this machine, this device has software, is moving away to the notion of this user has software. And the software can begin to follow them. So there was a session yesterday that talked a little bit about sideloading and how we have this per-user construct. And there are still a few scenarios not adequately covered by sideloading, but the overall notion of this is your software and you can just bring it everywhere you want to go, and the store starting to support that to say, hey, these are all the software packages you've installed other places. Do you want to have them on this device? You know, App V in particular allows you to just say, have this follow the user and just show up for them. I can have SCCM rules that say, have this just show up for the user whenever they log on to a device, and have them bring it along with them. We haven't had a lot of rich support for it. If you look at where we stick things in the operating system, where do we stick program files? Well, we got a couple places. We stick them here or here. First class citizens. Where do we stick program files for the user? Well, they're in a hidden directory, so I can't see it in the first place. And we've kind of converged upon, we stick them in this little apps directory. And we have this sort of really strange series of directory structure to go through. But eventually I get to my apps. And here they are, and I can see that I've got the various redirections. This is a ClickOnce app. Here's another ClickOnce app. No real standard, though. We had to create the apps directory. It didn't exist. We had to build it. So we have no default way of putting things in the user scope, even though we're trying to drive that to be a standard. So I think we have some opportunities to clarify our stance there further. I think it's okay to do that. If you're building an MSI and want to target per user scope, you can. But you have to follow one of the most confusing series of instructions ever if you don't want to have to go through a UAC prompt on your way to do that. If I want to build a package and have it installed per user, it's real simple. The all users property, I make sure that's set to false. And I just reach into bit 3 in the word count summary, in the summary information stream, bit 3, remember that one, that's real easy, obvious, isn't it? And set it to 0. And all of a sudden, you're okay. Possible. But I need to think about where I'm going to put things. And finally, there's the concept of the local scope, which is really what we do most of the time in the Windows 8 app world, which is you don't even have to have access to the device. This is not anywhere in my user directory. I have a little bucket you're going to stick me into, and I can't reach out of it. When we think about the evolution of software in general, and I talked a bit about this the other day, the evolution of software is really moving more towards building small software experiences that really cover a specific scenario, as opposed to continuing to build app Taj Mahals that try to cover all scenarios before we ship them. And this little local scope, the idea of really filling an end scenario tied back to cloud services, to me, is the eventual end goal, and that's the evolution. We will continue to have global scope apps, we will continue to have user scope apps, and we're gradually moving towards local scope apps, and that, to me, is going to significantly improve quality. The less you have to target a specific system, the better job you can do. We also are moving away from the notion of always having an online or live operating system to being able to support having an offline operating system. And that's where Open Packaging Conventions helps us. So what do I do today? Number one, we need to start instrumenting the quality of our packages over time. Measuring them and identifying the trends, what's causing us to have failures? And how much are they costing us? So I can begin to build standards and checklists based upon failure rates, not based upon whether or not I can get this to run on my machine or whether or not it seems like it's a little bit easier to manage loading it up into my software distribution system. but based upon what really is an organizational cost today. Build your checklist based on failures, not based on your convenience and not based on what you choose to ask for. When possible, moving away from custom actions, from custom code that directs how to install things, is directionally the where things are going, looking at the appropriate scope and thinking about how open packaging conventions may provide a better solution. I'm short on time, meaning I have lots of time left. So I'd like to sort of open it up for questions, because that's sort of the canned presentation I've got today. Any questions from the group about packaging in general? I'd love to hear your feedback as we start the conversation of thinking about packaging again. Yeah?
What's the Office 2013 using for its packaging and deployment?
What's Office 2013 using for its packaging and deployment? The default distribution mechanism is based upon AppV. So we are, you know, it basically takes the AppV concept and the AppV package and puts it together under its own, you know, mechanism for doing that. In fact, it's so similar to AppV, you can just run it through a quick command to convert it from the click-to-run package into an AppV package for distribution within an AppV governed environment. We're also looking at whether or not it makes sense to do that for, you know, App Store distribution of desktop apps. Could we use a similar concept there? So if Microsoft is licensing the Install Shield technology, which is hard to use, and yet we have Wix, why haven't we put them together? Is that the question?
Yeah.
That's an excellent question. I don't know why we don't ship Wix with Visual Studio, particularly now that we have the ability to incorporate using NuGet packaging to auto-suck down any updates and give alerts and notifications. I think we should. We probably have some long-standing licensing agreements with them. I know that as the sort of the de facto, or if you will, the last product standing in the packaging field, that there's probably some long-term agreements put in place. I don't know all the details there. But I would agree that I think we should have, you know, Wix, you know, I personally would just put it in place and have it just pushed down through NuGet. Yes, in the orange shirt. Have we done analysis of AppV versus MSI? We've done a ton of analysis around that, and what we find is that most customers who make the transition to AppV for their software deployment and software packaging solution start to see ROI within 9 months. And a lot of the reason behind that is because the cost of sequencing is so significantly lower than the cost of packaging that they immediately start saving money and time on just creating the packages in the first place, and they start to drive value after that. Now, what tends to really drive that is if I am in a transition anyway where I'm likely to have to do repackaging. So we see a lot of folks who do that in conjunction with a transition from, say, XP to Win 7. They're already, in many cases, having to redo a significant percentage of applications, sometimes nearly all of them. And so, therefore, since they were doing it anyway, they accelerate the time to value on it that way. But it's an average of 9 months before they have a positive ROI. Other questions?
So is this all supported in System Center configuration?
Is this all supported in System Center configuration? Which aspects, sir?
Well, using Configuration Manager and packaging your application.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so of all the things we've talked about, Windows Installer XML compiles to MSIs, which are, of course, supported in System Center fully. When we looked at what we have with CoAP today, CoAP today is based upon building into NuGet packages, which is integrated with Visual Studio, and Visual Studio then takes the accountability for doing the servicing as opposed to System Center. So that's a separate mechanism than System Center. But the directionality we've done in terms of the tools and their evolution is to leverage PowerShell, which means we'll be able to then leverage anything that can use PowerShell in the future as this space continues to evolve. Yeah.
So if Apple is ready for prime time, what's the tooling around it in order to help us build and deploy using AppV?
So what is the tooling around AppV to help us build and deploy it? AppV comes with a sequencer, which is what nearly everybody uses. There have been a couple of third-party tools that people have built. I know that Admin Studio has the ability to dynamically generate some packages, though not all of them. Most of the folks that I know do use the sequencer, which in essence involves you running the installation and capturing it, and then packaging it up that way, and been really successful with that. What's super frustrating to me, I mean, again, I looked at the numbers early on in the presentation where it's like, hey, this is a $2.5 billion industry based on rework, really, right? That's what app packaging is rework. Someone's already packaged it, you're just doing it again. Is because AppV is sort of held constrained by limitations of how you can get it. You have to have software assurance, and then you have to have MDOP. The percentage of people who have it becomes small compared to the scope of Earth. As a result, I don't know of any ISVs that ship AppV packages other than Office 2013. Adobe does now. Yeah, I know we tried to drive an initiative where we would at least start with whether it be cookbook or whether it be some kind of way of putting it together. So Adobe does. That's terrific. I hadn't heard that. Yes, we've tried, and with limited success. And so I think we have the opportunity to try different things to try and drive the ecosystem forward. It's really an interesting challenge, because when we mention to the field sales force, who have a quota around selling MDOP, like, hey, what if we just made this part of VOS? They're like, oh, whoa. Hold on, that's what sells me MDOP. That's what gets me SA. It's such a high-value thing. It's almost as if we'd have to come out with something else as terrific as AppV in order to pry AppV out of the hands of MDOP. And that's, I think, one of the challenges is a business one. It's the same thing with the investments in packaging in general is, if we make it slightly easier to package Windows, will you buy more Windows? And the answer to that so far has been, not really. There are other things we'll do that'll sell more copies of Windows, and so it gets deprioritized, which is why server and tools in the open source business is where the innovation's really been happening. Yeah?
Chris, is it the intention that in the future, things like packages and, components that you would install for all users, is it the intention that they'll start coming as AppVs as well, or recommending to package them as AppVs rather than MSIs?
So the question is, for components that are installed to all users, yep, are we looking to, so like platform level, give me an example of what you're thinking of.
Yeah, so something like, I know Flash is integrated now, but things like Java and all that sort of stuff, is it recommended to AppV those in the future, even though they're for all users?
Java and AppV, well, there's an interesting, the challenge with system-wide components is that when you think about building up an ecosystem, you've got to be really all in on AppV to make that kind of an approach work. Because if I say Java, I'm going to stick it inside of a bubble. Now, with AppV5 and later, I can start grafting bubbles together a lot more easily. So I can say, here's the Java bubble to which I can graft every other app that's also in a bubble. The challenge becomes, what if I have an app that can't go into a bubble that still needs Java? Then that doesn't work, right? So if I'm all in and I know that I understand how I can get there, then I can do it that way. But then you have challenges as well of, what about the browser? And what about multiple versioning? I've seen a lot of people use AppV really successfully to address compatibility issues with different components. And like when you think about Java, it's kind of a big deal to have old versions of Java lying around on your system. A big deal to the point where the United States Department of Homeland Security demanded that every government agency turn it off until they got an update and then deployed the update. Wow. Right? I mean, and which then, of course, drove the folks at Oracle to put up a warning, which actually got filed as a Windows bug. I was really amused by this. When I go to use this app, because I installed this old version of Java and stopped updating it, it says, this version of Java is out of date. You really ought to update it. They put that code in there. and they filed it as a Windows bug. Windows is telling me to update Java. No, 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 actually Java is telling you to update Java. That's not us. And so we start seeing people sort of targeting it. How do I isolate it and contain it to deal with what I need to do? Because that's, to me, the challenge is the upgrade cadence as it exists today is really quick. Yeah. And not everyone can keep up. The average lifespan of an enterprise application is 12 years with updates somewhere between 5 and 8. Right? So now I've got a cadence that's really fast and I can't necessarily keep up, which means I may end up getting stuck with something that I didn't notice was tied to a particular behavior of Java before. I don't want that on my system because it's really vulnerable. That lets me contain it. And as long as I can contain it and graft it with things, that works. When I get into IE, that becomes more difficult. So I don't think there's an easy answer, but I think it is often part of the solution, particularly when I'm doing it for compat reasons, to help me isolate it and contain it. And you know, it's kind of like putting a metal cover on a bomb. You'll still probably get hurt a little bit, but at least you're not going to be blown to bits. Yeah. So the future of AppX. So AppX, that file form is what we use both for AppX files for Windows 8 apps, which we hope people make a lot of, as well as the file format for AppV. So, you know, what strikes me as being very likely is somewhat, you know, us eventually building a format that looks a lot like AppX or is AppX for native installs using tools built on top of CoApp. We just, you know, haven't evolved that to the point where we had stuff to show today, right? And there were actually, I mean, and I showed you some of the blog posts, right? I wasn't trying to disclose anything or have any major announcements here, but you know, we thought we were going to have something built by the time this conference showed up, and I was like, oh, I have some really completely cool stuff to show, and now I just have you some sort of directional arrows and lots of time for Q&A. But to me, it's still very helpful because this really feeds back into helping us understand, are we building the right stuff to solve the problems that people are experiencing? And sounds like there's, I mean, like we're in this room with there's not just three people in the front row, so it seems to me some people care about this.
The problem I see is organizations are seeing iOS, easy, quick delivery, no packaging.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, and AppX is the same way. Visual Studio just spits out a package already, right? In the same way their development, I mean, they're packaged. The same way our stuff is packaged. Just that before, we and our development tools would spit out binaries, and we said, all right, go find a way to package them, right? And of course, we then either never bought the developer as a packaging tool set, or we bought them one in 1992 and never saw the reason to upgrade it, right? Honestly, the number one competitor for Install Shield is old versions of Install Shield. And probably on the order of 10% of the customers I work with have some dev teams in their org that are using Install Shield that's still 16-bit. Because it does everything they need to do with Install Script, right? And that's the challenge that they have. So having it spit out, right, having it be able to be checked into your source tree and having it spit out a fully functional package is absolutely magic, and that's what AppX does in Windows 8 apps. We just don't have that for desktop apps because everyone demands parity with MSI. And if you're willing to start pulling away the need for things like custom actions and starting to look at things from a narrower install scope, that's where you can start getting into some, you know, letting the magic happen that we, the same thing we have with Windows 8 apps that we can't do today, because by letting you do anything you wanted, then people did anything they wanted. Yeah?
Is there any intention to integrate AppV5 or future versions of AppV with Visual Studio to remove those installation issues?
Is there any plans to integrate AppV5 in Visual Studio to auto-generate AppV packages? Not that I'm aware of. And I think that may be based on some of the same issues that we see across the board, which is people aren't building those by default because not everyone has it. And so therefore, I've now built a package that not everyone can use. But potentially, that would be actually a really good add-on to build for Visual Studio. Note to self. Other questions, comments? Yes? When is App V going to support protected mode? How do you mean? So protected mode, like, mean low integrity level, or? So when it, so if I deal with something with low IL, the challenge is going to be permissions on the file systems. I mean, obviously, you can set the permissions to do that. I don't think I've ever actually seen an AppVed app that was running in low IL. So I don't think I'm aware of the problem, but I can look into it. So I don't know. What's that? Com Plus? Yeah, Com Plus, it would seem to me, would need to get out, need to get outside of the AppV bubble in general, because it needs to run in more of a service context. I mean, that's the evolution of MTS. That would seem to me to be something that would be outside of the general capabilities of what it could do today. It's interesting that you're using Com Plus. I haven't heard people using that for a while. I'd be curious to hear about the scenario there. I mean, I know that there are some really good things. I mean, we built MTS in the first place to solve some legit scenarios. I've just seen people solving them in different ways. The question is, how much into the future is that relevant? And if it continues to be relevant for a long time, perhaps we need to be thinking about it. Other questions, comments? Great. Well, with that, thank you all for coming. Hopefully, we can together start raising the bar and building better packages that are more successful over a longer period of time. Thanks for coming.